Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and welcome with me my guest, George Saunders. This is, for me, a special occasion because I've been talking to George since, I think, his first book of stories came out. How many years later?
Since 1996, whatever that math and is.
21 yeah. years later, this, Lincoln in the Bardo, is his first novel. And I... You know, opinions mean nothing. I hope in the course of listening to the program, you'll be convinced. I think this is his very best book. I think that somehow or other, the intensity, integrity, responsibility, and concern for life have landed in this book and made it into an American work of spiritual literature. If we have inherited the Tibetan Book of the Dead, this is the American Book of the Dead. And I wanted to begin by asking you, this is such a different book. How did you go about it?
Well, it was partly a long germination. I'd heard the idea many, many years ago and just was like, I don't think I can do that. And then, so in a sense, I think I kind of, you know, as a person and artistically kind of grew. And then at some point it seemed like it might be doable. So really it was the same, I'd say the same artistic method as I'd always used in the past, but just a slight self-daring to say, look, you know, you're 54 years old. You know, is it really the case that this is going to be permanently beyond you? If so, that's very sad. That's an artistic death sentence. So it was sort of an attempt to, you know, use the same audacity in terms of aspirational audacity, to use that and just say, all right, you know, that actually means you have to be very fearful of repetition, repeating yourself. And just luckily this idea was there that I could feel would force me out into thin ice a little bit.
I'm hoping to walk out on that thin ice. The book is asking what happens between this life, the one we know, and the next life, which means to begin with that it has as its first presumption that there is a next life. They don't know, the characters in this book, what that next life will be. It hasn't been revealed to them. To write a book in which it is a sure thing that there is a futurity, how dare you? How dare you risk that?
I believe it. I mean, that's actually the real truth. I just think when I was a kid, I was a very serious Catholic, and now I'm an aspiring Buddhist. So to me, it's kind of second. It would be the most surprising thing if we switched off and there was nothing. It might be the case. But so partly it's inherent belief. And then you say, well, and even if it's not true, it should be true. But of course, the real answer is I actually don't care if it's true or not. You know, you get into this and the idea of any work of art is through dramatic shaping to make some crazy moment of transcendence, you know.
Well, I'd say that this book, this novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, George Saunders' first novel, is interested in exploring the relationship between fiction and belief. Since fiction deals with that which is not so, and belief deals with that which may not be so, the nearness of the functions is very startling. It's a narrative about grief, about the death that age, what is it?
11, I think.
Yeah. Of Lincoln's son, Willie. And the book is assembled out of bits of extraordinary research. You did an enormous amount of Lincoln reading, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah. Oh. But what all this research does is tell you, on this set of pages, Willie was the most blessed boy imaginable, with a curl in the middle of his forehead and a dearness of manner. But we skip to the next chapter, and he was a wastrel, a monster, a running fiend. On this page, Abraham Lincoln has beautiful gray eyes. Mid-page, they're pierced with blue, and by the bottom of the page, they're pure blue. There's no such thing, even in current reports, as truth. So the book sets up for the reader that all of our senses deal with the hypothetical. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I love the idea that if you were looking for the God's eye view of human nature and you're in a room of 16 people, you really have 16 parallel internal monologues running full speed. That's it. There is no, the compilation of those is the God's eye view. And within those, you're going to have two people looking at the same object, finding it beautiful, finding it ugly. So I found traces of that in the historical documentation, and somehow it just seemed deep.
While the carriages and the procession going to the cemetery was very long, and it had to be rerouted around streets so that there could be a procession, those people in life who feel Lincoln's grief, some of them worked in the White House as butlers and maids, and they knew and loved Willie. But the people we're going to really be spending time with are the people in the cemetery who've been there. They have not moved on to the next life.
Right.
They've fiercely held on to this one. They refuse to believe that they are dead. They refer to themselves as being ill and to their coffins as being sick boxes. And since most of them have been ill with what have you, typhus, venereal disease, they are awaiting recovery. And they expect to go back, because once they die, life is beautiful. There's something that has been surrendered that maybe even during life you hadn't appreciated enough, and now you have to live in the hope,
right,
that you can have it. But children coming to their deaths, these children don't have the history of yearning, and they are expected to hurry with the briefest interval between this life and whatever the next one holds. That interval is the bardo. Right. That's what the bardo means, the instant or lengthy period between life and death.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, in the proper usage, even we're in a bardo right now, there's several of them. We're in the bardo between birth and death. So the sort of popular bardo is the one that, I think.
As I understand it, there are 6 or 7,
right,
bardo periods.
Right. But I partly use that word in the title just to remind myself to keep death non-static. Even as a former Catholic, if I said purgatory, I know what that means. The bardo, I did read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but it's difficult. And this is not that bardo, actually. This is it leaps off from there, but there's a lot of things that I'm not presenting correctly in this one. So it was almost a way of reminding myself that, you know, if we died and it was just like we expected, that would be pretty nuts, you know. So the word bardo triggered me to say, you don't know what it is. And fictively, it should be somewhat destabilizing for the reader.
Lincoln, who's lost a child, is in the darkest grief imaginable, because this is the nation just prior to the Civil War.
It's been declared, but only 3,000 people have died so far. And they're just getting the sense that this is a real mess and it's going to get worse. And also, you want, one of the things I found on that reading was that the a lot of the writing about those kind of battles and the depictions are quite sanitized, because this was when they were first, you know, the cannon shot and those kind of things were just ripped the hell out of people's bodies, you know, in almost comical ways. So these young guys leaving their homes would suddenly see the carnage beyond what they could even have imagined. And this is in a period where the good death was very valued. You're supposed to die at home with surrounded by loved ones praying. And this would be someone talking to you, and suddenly their head would be gone. So quite traumatic for the country. And I think it affected the way people thought about death. Suddenly it was the national topic.
I'm talking to George Saunders about his first novel after all these years, Lincoln in the Bardo. What is the Bardo?
So the Bardo is a Tibetan word for, it actually just means transitional space. So here we're talking about that particular one that starts the minute you kick off. And in the Tibetan tradition, it goes until you assume a rebirth. And I think, strictly speaking, in the Tibetan tradition, it's got a limited time. And depending on your spiritual state in this life, you'll have a different experience. For some people, I think it just flies by. But there's some talk that you would experience a period of wild hallucination that terrifyingly isn't disconnected from the way your mind functions right now. So if you have certain neurotic concerns, or even if you think in spiritual, certain spiritual symbols, those are all going to get supersized at the moment of death. And there's this idea that you're in this life, your body and your body has the effect of tamping your mind down a little bit. And at the moment of death, it's all bets are off.
Now, despite the presence of Lincoln and Willie, who loves his father and is staying in this half-life because he enjoys the prospect of his father's visits, the book is really narrated by three dead people who've stayed alive because of a knowledge about life that they have not been able to fulfill.
Yeah.
One of them has been in love with other men, and in fact, it's not just that he's lost the man he loved. He didn't lose him to heterosexuality. He lost him to another man.
Right.
So the sadness that he feels keeps him in this half state. Another of the three narrators has been about to consummate his chaste marriage to a younger woman who loved him dearly, who is only now confiding to him, "I am ready for you to explore me and for us to explore the new continent of love." And that day, he's a printer, a beam falls on his head and he dies.
Wow.
Well, you invented this. And the third of them is, in fact, a minister who has been given perhaps too dire a picture of the judgment between the half-life he's in and the heaven and hell alternatives.
Right, he's the one of the group that's actually gone through that gate and then come running back terrified.
He's seen what is available in the darker life in what's called an excremental mirror, and he knows that what is to be found there is not what he wants.
Right.
He thought he had lived a virtuous life, but now he's fairly sure that something he did not understand had gone wrong. Had he been too vain? Had he thought he was obedient to God or the gods when in fact he hadn't understood obedience?
Yeah.
So these three people are people who've held on to the halfway life. They live in the cemetery. They're like ghosts, but they're not really ghosts. What do you think they are?
Well, I tried, you know, when I was writing Civil War Land, I just tried so hard to avoid the use of the phrase theme park because it reduces. So here they're saying that they're, I mean, I refer to them as ghosts, but they're not ghosts because ghosts have white sheets and they float around saying boo. I think of them as energy leftovers. And one of the things that I didn't know but found during the writing was that they are very, it's very sad because they only stay by repetition of certain narratives, which then reduces them. Maybe sometimes you see the way very old people are reduced to two or three narratives that they use to sort of keep their identity in place. And so they have forgotten much of what they were, but just by sheer force of repetition, they can kind of will themselves to stay in this place.
Well, let me tell you what I think makes this book astounding. I mean, really astounding, because I think a book can have all sorts of wonderful and interesting ideas, but unless they're matched by style, by stylistic discovery, they're just ideas. They may even be dramatized ideas, but the writing has to reflect them. These three men realize that they have to somehow break the boundary between life and death and convince Abraham Lincoln to tell his dead son, Willie, to go on to the next world, whatever it is. And so, in order to do this, they break the bounds of the body and the non-body. They enter Lincoln, they enter Willie. Suddenly, each of them knows the other's stories. They've entered the full body, the full memory, the heartbeat of others. And when that happens, the other living dead follow. And Lincoln is swarmed by the dead. The dead, including people who've been slaves, including beaten and raped women. In other words, Lincoln, if he hasn't already been the person who could eventually write the Emancipation Proclamation, he is being in this book filled with human empathy. And human empathy in this book is being imagined as a joining of memory and voice. And that is, in fact, accomplished in this book by characters who begin speaking in each other's voices. It's no longer just reference points. Now, it's as if they're quoting each other, and they're quoting each other the way we would quote encyclopedias. They're quoting the knowledge of life that another person brings to the table. Now, how did you think of that? I don't think I've ever seen it before.
I think we'll just stop there. That's perfect. We'll end the interview there. No, thank you so much. The truth is, for me, I have, over the years, become, as we've talked about this, but become increasingly confident that, at least for me, the artistic process is very much about a kind of high-level form of intuition that manifests in the line-to-line level. And just because of my particular mind and maybe background, if I plan much, it doesn't go well for me. So as I've gotten older, I've become increasingly, I guess, confident might overstate it, but assured that if I can, every day I go in to write, I tend to try to read from the beginning and just fully inhabit that, you know, that moment when one's mind is so open during reading, when there are literally thousands of data points being adjusted, and actually we can perceive them, we do perceive them. So my thing is, I trust that if I can get into some simulation of that mind, the story will tell me where the heat is. And with this one, again and again, I would write myself into a kind of a banal treatment and be repulsed by that and come out. But another way to say it is that idea of a living being and a dead being co-inhabiting goes way back to Civil War land. The end of that story is exactly that. A guy gets killed and he inadvertently passes through his murderer. So I think part of what an artist does is you keep in mind that you don't have a whole lot of stuff to do. You know, I have a pretty narrow ledge of talent. But you remember that you have that idea and then you think, can I do that at a higher level? So once the concept of, you know, empathy being represented by cohabitation is in your mind, then if you're alert, you can find bigger canvases on which to do that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with George Saunders about his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with George Saunders about his latest book, Lincoln in the Bardo, a story that stems from the grief surrounding the death of Lincoln's 11-year-old son and continues with that son's stay in something between limbo, purgatory, the Bardo. The book is published by Random House. Now, you see, if what Whitman managed to do was to create a chorus of Americans, of American life, I don't want to praise you too highly.
Go ahead.
But I feel like you're doing a mixed chorus of American life and American death. And that on some level, the country is both a dream and a reality. And the dream America is often known best by the America to be, or the America that's lost. There they are in this novel, about to experience what might be the breaking of the bounds of union. And so this may be a chorus about the end of America as it has been known, or the beginning of the America that failed when it had the opportunity to, with the founding fathers, to eliminate slavery.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I finished this book and then about a month later went on the Trump campaign for The New Yorker. And that was really something to have.
You weren't campaigning.
No, I was covering
for
it.
Trump.
I was covering it. Yeah, I wasn't helping. And that was beautiful, you know, to have had to have seen this one example of a president who under duress had an expanding cone of empathy, you know, to include everybody, including these Americans enslaved by other Americans, and then to hop into this other thing where it seemed like the cone of empathy was shrinking down to include just, you know, people like him. But I think it's a very strange thing to have written this book and then say, the way you just described it, that's it. Maybe it's always been thus, but it's certainly more clear to us now.
So the book was completed by then?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
By far.
Uh-huh. So that the book contains within it a sort of prescient fear of the possibilities that lie ahead in America.
I would like to think so, but it also, you know, I was startled to read in the research to see how close it, well, it had gone past destruction by that in the Civil War, and we sort of brought it back. But, I mean, that, you know, that's, it's sort of, it's kind of maybe corny, but I mean, the idea that we, as you say, we've never actually gotten it right. We have a beautiful aspiration. We've never quite been there. And now we, what we've seen, I think, in my politics is that in the last year, we've been reminded that we weren't as close as we thought. It was in sight. But there are a lot of forces that are in play now, that were in play then, that would like to see a very, very different America than many of us imagine.
Could it be that writers have a deeper awareness of the zeitgeist? Because several other writers who we've talked to recently, Steve Erickson with Shadowbound, NK3 by Michael Tolkien, have had a vision of the death and rebirth of union.
I think so. I mean, in some ways, it feels to me almost mechanical because the state of mind that one goes into when making a work of fiction is quite extraordinary. I think it's maybe...
Do you call it clairvoyance?
Well, my understanding of clairvoyance is it's just extremely heightened awareness. You know, if somebody was, a true spiritual master and was very highly aware, they could read in your posture your destiny. So I don't think it's clairvoyance in any kind of woo-woo sense, but I think it's being deeply attentive to that which is. And, you know, this Trump movement was not hidden 2 years ago. It was in clear sight for those who would look. And people like me who are aghast and confused right now, my feeling is, well, fiction writer, that's on you. If America's not the America you thought it was, that's not America's fault. That's my fault for not having been more perceptive. But maybe on some deeper level, we are.
Well, we've talked about the content and themes of Lincoln and the Bardo, but for me, of course, a book is not being discussed until you're hearing its sounds and talking about the kind of style it invents. So next week, we'll be continuing our talk about Lincoln in the Bardo by my guest, George Saunders. I'm Michael Silverblatt. The book has been published by Random House. Thank you, George, for joining me.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Yes, it is always. I'm always happy to see you. I feel like we've grown up together.
Well, you have certainly helped me grow up, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Lincoln in the Bardo at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when George Saunders is our guest.
I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.